The driver has probably been driving that bus for like 30 years.
It was shocking. I was like, how do you train for this without dying? Like, I don't understand.
Well, I think you don't. I just think he's the one that survived.
Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 158 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam. I'm looking across a beautiful new podcast room.
I'm Sam, and I am shocked by the progress that has been made.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is June 2018. Before we start, we have a warning. Anything can happen in this show. There's going to be profanity and lewdness. So if you're a child, and you can get your face away from the radio. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We are on the radio now.
Radios can also electrocute you, which is another good reason to get your face away from them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They're like outlets. You gotta make sure you childproof your radio.
You gotta cover all the holes. Don't let forks get poked in there.
Those little plastic things.
Yeah. Don't go bring it into the bath.
No.
That's right.
Not even once.
Right. These are just some of the safety tips you're going to pick up from listening to our show.
Yeah. These aren't even the best ones.
No. That's just a little safety appetizer for you.
Uh-huh.
All right. Let's get on to the news for this week. First thing, we want to thank everybody who has been donating to our Ko-fi page, which is over at tips.bscotch.net. So we need to shout out for Horace, Andrew Heather, Andreas, Zach, Mike G, somebody whose name is just A, just the letter A, which is really badass.
Yeah, that's a name.
Hot Claw, also good. Mm-hmm. Scale Plexus, Jeff Huber, Matrone, and Giant Muskrat, all who gave us some cash to help support the podcast, which we appreciate tremendously.
Especially now we got this new fancy room, because it did cost money to put these sound dampeners onto all these walls.
Yeah, this room is
build them and everything.
This room was not meant for what we're using it for. So.
Yeah, so if the audio sounds a little bit different, like Patrick from Fat Bar did the best he could.
Mm-hmm.
I think he did pretty good. And he did a good job.
You can feel it. You open the door and you walk in here and it's like...
I still feel there's a little bit of reverb, just like this.
Don't worry, he'll handle that in post. That's no problem.
That's right.
So otherwise, we are back in business, in the sense that Sam is back in business from China. So we have a huge review day today, where we're going to go over all the things that have happened in the past couple weeks. Sometimes it's hard to realize just how many things we're doing generally.
Well, this is something that Adam and I always go back and forth on, because I'm generally stressed out that not enough is happening, and Adam's generally very amused at how much is happening, and so we tend to have this conversation usually like once a month, where I'm like,
we're not making any progress.
And Adam's like, you back up.
So Sam stepped away for 2 weeks.
Yeah, so it's funny, because I also just didn't really have much internet, because to get into the studio feed, which is where everyone puts their notes about what they're doing, you have to authenticate through Google. And you can't access Google in China. Okay. So I couldn't keep up on news. I just saw occasional tidbits popping into the Discord whenever I had sort of random Wi-Fi access. And so, yeah, yesterday we landed into Chicago and had about a 4-hour layover. And so it took like an hour and a half I read through all my emails that I'd had, and then went into the feed and just read through everything. And I was like, what the fuck? What is happening? The Ko-fi thing didn't exist when I left. And now you guys are like, oh, yeah, we actually made money from the podcast while you were gone.
Yeah.
And I was like, what?
And again, huge thanks to everybody who threw money.
Yeah, it's incredible.
We
just set it up and we're like, maybe we'll get a dollar.
We get maybe three or four people who would maybe do like a recurring monthly, like $4, and be like, oh, yeah, I'll give like $1 an episode or something like that. Because I could see that mental calculus happening in like a tiny fraction of people, you know? No, people were...
Well, see, the way we have it set up is, we framed it as like, if you want to buy us a cup of coffee to support the podcast and as a thanks or whatever, it's like a cup of coffee is $4, mm-hmm. And all these people have come together and collectively bought us hundreds of cups of coffee. Yeah.
It is great, because like one of the big dreams...
We got some real heavy hitters in there, too.
Yeah, one of the big dreams of the podcast was just to not ever have to put ads in it. And then it's like, oh, here's a way. So that happened. And then all this other, there's all cool stuff with Levelhead, which we'll talk about a little bit later. I was genuinely shocked. And I remember when I left, Seth was like, my goal is to frighten you upon return. You come back, you're like, what is up? What is down? What is happening? So it worked. Everyone kicked a bunch of ass. It is really nice to to have that level of disconnect and then come back in and, like you said, actually get sort of an accurate picture of what the hell happens over here. And it also pointed out to me, I mean, we try to do a lot of early marketing efforts and stuff with our games, and we've always talked about how it's just hard because of how fast the dev goes on these things, where even the alpha trailer that we made, the teaser trailer for Levelhead, 1 week after it was done, we had added and changed a bunch of things that would have made it, of course, way better.
Yeah.
And that's just sort of how it always is, unfortunately, for us. Like, there's no period of time where things are just kind of
like ready to market.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you kind of just have to pick, like, okay, well, it's good enough, you know, now to show some cool features of, but knowing that in a week or two, it will be just way better. And it'll just always be way better. And so,
yeah. And there's that, you know, first impressions matter a great deal. And so there's also that kind of push pull where, like, you don't want to show it in a bad state, but you also want to show it early so you can build hype.
Yep.
And so you got to try to find, like, where's the line? Where's with Scuffle Buddies, we haven't shown any actual video of it because we don't know whether or not what's there is right. Like, we don't know whether that's going to even.
Early.
Yeah. So it's hard. Things change fast.
Yeah.
So, all right. So before we go into talking about Levelhead and some other stuff, let's talk about China.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where Sam was.
Yeah, so I had a really interesting visit. We went to specifically go visit my wife's family who lives over there. So this is her family who's in the States is actually just her core nuclear family. It's just her mom, her dad, and her brother. And they actually don't have any relatives here. So all those relatives still live over in China. They're the only ones who came over. And this was also, I think, this was their second time being back. The first time back was, at least for her mom, was 2 years ago after like 30 years of not going. So it's funny because their frame of reference, like, they still call everything a village.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I've been to villages before. So, you know, I've traveled to Eastern Europe a little bit and also some other places where you have actual villages that are small.
Just like 100 people.
Well, we're also from the Midwest.
From the Midwest.
We call them towns, but come on.
They're basically villages.
They're villages.
I mean, Grinnell's basically a high level village at this point.
Yeah. Or the town our grandparents are from, which has 300 people in it.
A true
which
village.
I think is a village.
Right.
And it recently lost its post office because there weren't enough people to justify having a post office. Right. That's a legit ass village right there.
So this is where I was sort of mentally framing all this stuff. And then we go and it's, I couldn't get over the scale of everything. Yeah, so we start in Shanghai and it's sort of like the, people call it like the New York of China, right? So tons and tons of these skyscraper buildings, tons and tons of business. But the one thing that was weird is that, and I didn't realize the extent to this, like whenever you travel, you tend to actually learn way more about your home country than you do about the other country, right? By the contrast. And the extent to which diversity is a thing in the States, I've always understood because of course I've traveled a little bit, but.
People call it, you know, the melting pot of cultures in the US and stuff.
When we were in Shanghai, I saw like maybe 8 other white people.
We were there for 4 days. Millions and millions of
on the subway, run around. And it was just weird. Like I had people coming up to ask for selfies with me because I'm a white person. And it was
just
because, like,
you're clearly from somewhere else.
Yeah. Whatever, and they would like, they would call you foreigner or like they would ask, you know, where you, they didn't know where I was from, but they, you know, obviously wasn't from there. And it was just,
they didn't care. Strange. They just wanted the selfie.
Yeah. They just wanted the selfie. Very strange. And also just like the sameness generally of the population was so interesting to sort of behold. Where there wasn't much in the ways of diversity and stuff like that. And so I know, like, we've had conversations here about, you know, how do you handle inclusion? How do you handle just tons of this stuff related to the fact that in the States in particular, we have this really messy job of having to, like...
We got lots of people from lots of places.
Yeah, you got to figure out how to talk about it. And then you know, going over there and seeing this almost, like, this very homogenous sort of population, at least in some of these city centers, and realizing that there's just... Like we're operating in a completely different context. So, you know, there was this prom dress thing with the white girl in the US who wore like a Chinese dressed prom. And it was like sort of blew up on Twitter just a couple weeks ago. And I remember at some point they had asked people in China, like, what do you think about this? And they're like, well, I don't care. It's like, well, of course you don't care. You don't have you're not in the same context as what we are. Like, you're not dealing with these same sort of problems.
Yeah. Right? And the US people are talking about this stuff a lot, especially nowadays. So it's just very much on people's mind of how to navigate these questions.
Yeah. So it was super interesting to see all that. And Diane and I had some really interesting conversations about that, my wife, while we were there. So that was a really interesting takeaway. The other one is that driving. People in the US drive as if their car is like this heavy shell that they're sort of like just kind of slinging around. And I think it's why it feels generally unsafe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there, people are just, It's like fucking Mario Kart, like all the time. I mean, everyone's just going every single direction, just whenever they want. We would just drive out in the street and then just pull a U-turn. Just in the middle of a four-lane highway.
It's everybody else's problem now.
No, it actually is. And the thing is, like, everyone is so aware and attentive and willing to move their car around. So in the U.S., if you did that, people just keep on barreling at you, right?
Yeah, we're basically just, we're actually driving small trains.
Basically,
you know?
Yes.
Because you get on the track, and then if anything happens, well, now you're in an accident.
Yeah, and actually, I only saw one accident, and it was like a tiny little bumper thing between an SUV that was just pulling a U-turn and a bus that stopped because of
heat. Yeah, this was my experience in India as well, was just realizing that actually driving in that context, it's just a whole different
skill.
And I think actually in the U.S. we have this thing where, like, we've got quite a few people. We also have a lot of space. Mm-hmm. So we spread everybody out, and everybody's got a car just about.
Yep.
And so everybody's driving, but the traffic isn't quite chaotic enough that you need to pay attention all the time.
Yes.
And so that's when you have, like, people texting and driving. Like, you could not do that
in
India or China. Like, because honestly, as soon as you look away from the road, you're dead now.
Yeah. Well, the crazy thing, so we go to, and you mentioned this in the podcast last week, but we went to Zhaojiejie, which is the national park where Avatar was inspired from. And so that's the one that you've probably seen a bunch of pictures of it online, where they have these huge vertical cliffs just, like, sort of erupting out of the ground. It's like a pillar.
They get bigger as they go up.
Yeah, and they're just like, they're just fat all the way up and huge, and they're covered in trees. And then there's, like, clouds and mist just in. It's just this wonderful sort of concept artist scene. And we go there, and to get up one of these mountains, you can either take a cable car, which just sort of skirts you up there in like 5 minutes, or you can take a bus, and you actually pay like extra money to take one of these buses. And there's 99 switchbacks to get up this mountain. It takes 20 minutes. And the driver just goes like 30 miles an hour the whole fucking time. Yeah. And there's other buses coming down. Okay. This is like a narrow ass road. And so literally everyone's just almost screaming the entire time.
Like, but the driver has probably been driving that bus for like 30 years.
It was shocking. I was like, how do you train for this without dying? Like, I don't understand.
Well, I think you don't. I just think he's the one that survived.
Probably. They hire a lot of bus drivers.
Yeah. And whoever survives, they're really good.
You just let nature take its course. You
know? That was one of my favorite things, was actually going up that, doing that switchback pass all the way up.
Yeah, I've seen some of those videos of that same kind of a moment in a whole bunch of different, countries and contexts. And every time I'm watching those things, and I could tell, like, the person who's driving, like, it has to be just fucking stellar. But still, I would never do it. Not a chance in hell.
My perspective on driving has shifted a lot ever since we changed the office space. Because I drove maybe 3 minutes a day at most. And it was always on, you know, smaller roads with lower speed limits and stuff. And because I just never drove longer distances or on the interstate or whatever, then when it came time to do road trips or make a trip downtown or something, it was just this incredibly nerve-wracking experience where, like, I don't have the intuition of, like, when I'm driving, you know, to, like, squeeze into areas where, you know, there's a gap on the interstate and I can squeeze in between cars or whatever. I just didn't have that, you know, instinct.
You got that experience at that point, yeah.
And so it's kind of like when you first start driving and how you're, like, always checking your mirrors and you're nervous about everything. You know, that's just generally been my experience with driving longer distances through cities and stuff. But now that I've been, you know, commuting to the office for a few weeks now, I can already tell that I'm just, like,
starting to feel the nonchalance.
Yeah, I'm just way more in tune with everything, and I'm just not worried about stuff anymore. And,
well, it was actually one of the things. Nice. Because I always liked sitting in the front, especially of the buses, because also, like, when we happened to be at that park, it basically, there was just clouds that day. And what that meant in the park in particular is that we were literally just in a cloud because it's up in the sky. And so I think it was after like the 50th switchback, visibility dropped like 30 fucking feet. Okay. So, and this bus is just going.
Just still going. Just like,
whatever. And so we're just like slinging our way up this mountain. And then they have these U-turns because you have to do a switchback, which is like a full rotation in the other direction. And it's a bus. Like, there's 40 people in it and it has a big wide arc. And then it's just a cliff. Right. And you could just, you look out there and all you see is white because there's sun shining, but there's this huge cloud that you're in. And it's like, you're in a studio lighting setting, right? It's just this diffuse white light. And I'm like, we're just going to go flying off this damn thing. But my favorite part about it was that the drivers were so good, like, just so aware of where their vehicle was, that there were a few times where they were going and neither bus slowed down at all. But like,
yeah, right.
We're turning around, like doing 100% U-turn on one of these cliff edges where if we get hit by this incoming bus, we're all dead. And the other bus also doesn't slow down at all because he knows where he's going. And they just pass each other in the rearview mirrors, just like within like
they two just inches. They just sort just of, high-five. They gently high-five rearview mirrors.
And I'm like, how the fuck do you guys know how close this is? And then we were driving in one of
I've been driving my car for 10 years and I'm still always unsure when I'm pulling into a parking spot. You know, I'm still unsure.
Where's the back? I especially can't tell where the fuck the back of my car is.
Yep. Ever. Yeah. Well, so the best one too is that we were at one point we were in one of the cities we're driving and everyone's got there's tons and tons of scooters there. And usually it's like three people on a scooter. Okay. So this would be like a high level fatality in case one of these scooters crashes because it's just jam packed with people. No one's got helmets on. They're just kind of hanging on. And we were in this cab and this bus sort of just swings in alongside of us all of a sudden. And the cab is just driving. And then the scooter sort of like dives in between us and a parked car. And so the cab has to slow down a little bit, but he doesn't stop. Right. He just like slows down a little bit. And then he's just going. And I couldn't tell. We were so close to that scooter that I couldn't figure out how we were not hitting it. Like I was like, my understanding of the front of this vehicle is that we are now inside that scooter. Like, I don't
know. There's some kind of clipping happening.
We were still just moving. Like nobody was stopping. And it was like, I just loved the whole thing. It was like beautiful to see.
But again, I mean, it's just that, you know, the more you're exposed to that. Because, you know, the idea that you would not know where the front of your car is would be crazy to somebody who's used to driving in that city.
Yeah, like, how could you be so bad at driving?
Yeah, how could you be, how could people let you
exactly
in?
Exactly where it is.
Yeah, no, like down to the millimeter.
Yeah.
You know, not just vaguely where.
Yeah, so that one was really incredible. And then one of the other interesting sort of cultural insights was the treatment of the national parks themselves. So we went to Zhangjiajie, which is, again, the Avatar Forest sort of thing. And that was the major one we spent time at, but it was really interesting because they have so many people that visit these sites that it's not like in the US where you just sort of like walk onto a vague path and then there's a bunch of vague paths hiking into the woods, right?
And maybe every 10 minutes you'll see somebody walk past.
And, right.
Yeah.
And also you're hiking in the US. So like I was prepared to hike, right?
Yeah. Like on rough terrain.
Rough terrain, like climbing stuff. It's like an amusement park, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like everything is paved everywhere and you're just on walkways the whole time. Anytime there's a big attraction, there's literally a queue. So there's like a four row deep queue to get onto whatever the thing is. So at one point, and we happen to be going like during one of the hottest seasons and school's not out yet, which apparently is like the best time to go. It's like going to Disneyland on an off season, right? So still a little bit of lines, but not really much compared to normal. And we waited for a cable car at one point to go down this big mountain. And this is, again, a cloudy day. So we can't actually see anything for the first 10 minutes of this cable car, which is one of my funniest pieces of the whole thing. But the queue line for it was like six rows deep. And I'm looking at this and there's only like 10 people in line with us, but I'm just looking at the rest of this line that could exist. And I'm like, is it real? Like, does that fill up all the way? And one of Diana's aunts was like, oh yeah, I was here last year to check it out. And we waited like 4 hours to get on this cable car. And I was like, oh, like it just stabs
it. It hurts your Midwestern soul. Know, the idea of waiting in a line for 4 hours for just any
to see the outside.
For anything
see
at all.
The outside. Yeah. That was it.
Honestly, like being from the Midwest, if somebody was like, listen, you have to wait 4 hours to get into heaven, I'd be like, I'm not.
No, wait a minute.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to just skip that.
I got better things to do. But
thank you. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that was kind of the other piece of it. But yeah, it was a really good trip. And we walked. I heard you guys cracking jokes, but how many miles we walked?
How many?
Last podcast. Well, I guess, what do you want to guess? So keep in mind, it was I think 16-day trip total, but two of those days were travel on either end. And then we traveled also for 4 days in there. So it's actually like 10 days of
Well, let's see. Activity. So you're with a family. Mm-hmm. So your walking pace is not going to be super brisk. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say maybe 2 miles an hour. Versus maybe three, which is like a pretty good, like it's a good
sure.
power walking pace. Mm-hmm. And you walked for probably like 50 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you probably walked 100 miles.
Walked 100 miles, exactly.
Yes!
You nailed it. Yeah, at the end of the trip.
Math.
My wife had her like pedometer thing on her phone. And so at the end of every day, we'd be like, how far did we go? How many steps did we climb? And yeah, we were like 101.2 miles or something like that. over the whole
pretty
trip.
Pretty good.
I mapped comically, the shit out of that.
I did definitely gain weight. So walking didn't do shit for me in terms of like stable. I walked 100 extra miles compared to usually I walk like 2 miles a day, right? I walked an extra like 85 miles over the last 2 weeks and also apparently ate probably just way too many calories.
Yeah, but as we discussed in last week's episode, you know, exercise literally just doesn't burn calories.
It just keeps your heart alive.
It's hilarious that your baseline, your body, just to like do its normal stuff, is burning, you know, like a good 2,000 calories a day.
Yeah, then when you do stuff that's hard.
You do stuff that's real fucking hard. You're like, I'm going to go swim or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, an 8% increase right. over baseline.
Yeah, does that
like,
mean that that our bodies are hugely inefficient just at baseline and that our exercise is something that we're really good at?
Could be.
Is that what that means? We're just like real bad at just being alive. So it's very costly.
Well, if you have 24 hours in a day and you burn about 2,000 calories.
I guess, yeah, if you go exercise for like 20 minutes really hard, it's still very small proportion of your day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I guess maybe the math works out, but it's still stupid. And
yeah, I'm definitely going to need to be hitting the gym now that I'm back getting my fat tire removed from around my midsection.
Yeah. Yep.
You just, if you just puncture it.
You just got to go down to Dobbs. Yeah. Be like, hey, I got this tire. I need to
get rid of it.
Yeah.
It's mainly dumplings and noodles from what I understand.
It's a dumple tire.
It's a dumpling tire.
Yeah.
It's the worst.
All right. So otherwise in the studio, we got a bunch of cool stuff that happened. For starters, last week, Adam and I were having a conversation about Level Headed. Adam just goes, you know, it'd be really cool if there was like an auto run mode, you know, where the character just runs by itself. Yeah, because we were talking about accessibility, you know, and the problem that, and it's something that we're concerned about is, you know, Crash Nest is a one-touch game, and we got a lot of comments from people saying, this is great because I have, you know, a disabled, like, left arm or something like that, but I can play still with a finger, and so I'm able to play Crash Lands on, you know, exploration mode, and it's awesome. And we've been kind of stressing about the fact that, you know, Level Head is a more skill-based game, and it's
very fast-paced.
It's fast-paced, and it's got two hands.
Most people will make very hard things.
Yeah.
Because that's how it's much easier to make a very hard thing than it is to make a well-balanced thing.
Yeah. So we got the hard things, I think, sort of solved in the sense that we're adding a bunch of filtering options to the search function. So you can filter levels by difficulty. So if you just don't want to play the mega uber hard levels, then it's fine. You don't have to. And you just remove them from your search results. But it's still the problem of, well, you still got to control left, right, you know, left, right, down, and then jump button with two different hands. And so having an auto run mode where instead the character runs on its own and you just jump by tapping the screen, then all of a sudden that opens up an entire new mode of gameplay. But then B, it opens up an entire new audience of people who otherwise wouldn't have been able to play the game. And so I was like, I could probably swing that. And then it took about 40 minutes.
That's how it always works.
And it was in there. Because it turns out you just need to make the character run to the right and otherwise leave everything the same.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So just stop taking inputs on the character. And that was easy. And then that also opened up the conversation of, what about those levels in Mario, you know, where like
where the level tries to kill you?
Where
the camera kills you?
The camera keeps moving and you got to keep up with it. You know, those levels were always super cool. And so we had a brief conversation about that. And then I realized, well, we've got this path system where you can put items on paths.
Why can't you put a camera?
What if we just made a specialized path that you can only have one of in your whole level? And once you put that path in there, now all of a sudden the camera is locked onto that path. And if the character goes outside of the view, they die. So now you can set up and because you can put paths on switches, you can even hook the camera movement to events that happen in the level.
So you could work your way normally up to a point and then switch the camera onto this thing.
Yeah.
And now you got to race the camera for a little bit, pop off of it and do normal level stuff.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So, and you can, and of course you can change.
You could use like enemy gates and stuff, you know, so you can basically stop it when you get to some point and then you have to kill some number of enemies before the camera turns back on again and keeps on traveling.
Right. So there's all kinds of cool stuff you can do with it now. And again, that was like an hour. So like every now and then we hit these just random ideas of like, oh, this would be a cool feature. And then it turns out the game is already set up to handle it.
Well, I think
and then sometimes you have an idea that seems even simpler than any of those.
And it takes weeks.
And it's basically impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's some cool stuff that's happening with Level Head. And then otherwise in the studio, we have started using Trello. Mm-hmm. So I think I think last week, did we talk about last week about project management? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we started using it last week, and after digging around, looking at things like Kanban, we looked at Trello, we looked at Asana, a whole bunch of different things. Mm-hmm. And Trello is free. So we're like, yes, that's, you know, plus 1,000 points on that one.
Yep.
But it basically, the way it works is kind of however you want to. You have these kind of like lists and stacks of cards, and then you can assign people to cards, and you can filter your view so that you only see the stuff that is assigned to you. But we kind of realized that we had this general problem with our processes where things sort of happen randomly. Mm-hmm. Like whenever we needed to communicate information about something to each other, it might happen verbally, it might happen over email, it might happen over Discord. And if you don't sort of, so that kind of puts the burden onto the recipient of the information
to handle it,
to then put it into their systems. Mm-hmm. And so if they don't drop everything when the information is delivered and handle the info and get it put into their systems, then it gets lost. Mm-hmm. And then they have to bother the sender of the information again to get the information again. Especially with things like Discord, where if you send it in a conversation and then you've got 1,000 different channels and it's a stream and it gets buried and stuff like that. So it's been super useful so far. And so we're gonna keep going with it.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'll have some work to do today to kind of migrate all my stuff in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which would be fun. It's one of those things where there tends to be a little bit of sort of individual personnel burden in order to sort of take up one of these collaborative group tools, right?
Yeah.
Which in a bigger group setting always makes obvious sense because
the overhead is already so high.
Exactly. Yeah. In a smaller group setting, it's one of those things where I think, you know, we've always had to feel it out. And I think now that we have Levelhead in particular being actually like a very big project that has all these moving parts with the web stuff, with all new art stuff we're doing and the new programming things. And then with Sure doing the, you know, the switch port for Crashlands and working on other stuff, there's just so much happening actually. And I think that was the other thing I saw, because I saw you guys switch to that project management tool. And then you're talking about it in like multiple days afterward, being like, oh, this is so nice. I actually know it's happening. Yeah. and then I even, because I'd gotten a bug report through the press inquiries thing, which I just sent to, because it was before I don't have my Trello account set up. So I just sent an email to Sure. We're like, here's the thing, you know. And instead of being able to just put it into
a card, dump the text into the card and assign Sure, and then whenever he can get to it.
So I was like, this would be nice. I think this would be
okay. Yeah. Well, and I think having everything centralized, because it's also the case that, you know, one of the things that I found myself doing was anytime I saw something in the game where I was like, oh yeah, we're missing that art asset or whatever, then I would take a screen cap of that, you know, I'd take a little snip of that area and you can attach it to the Trello card. And then, mm-hmm. so now instead of having to tell you like how to get to the thing, you just look at it and you're like, oh, I see it.
It's also nice because usually what I do to make a mock-up or to start working on a thing is actually get a screenshot of what the current setup of the game is. So if those are already there,
yeah, or if they're missing, then you just add a comment to the card. You're like, need screenshot. Mm-hmm. And
now it's Seth's problem.
It'll ping me and then I'll put one on there.
Right. You know? Yeah. Well, I think the struggle I've always had with any kind of a system mm-hmm. is that they're almost always opinionated.
Yes.
Right. And that there's
like how you should be doing your
work. They're designed around some idea of how it is supposed to be used. And every time I've used an opinionated system, it eventually became a problem because there were situations that didn't fit.
Yeah, Asana, I think, is more like that. Because I've used that before, and like we've tried to use it before.
Yep. Even Todoist.
Todoist, you know, definitely. Like,
Everything's a checklist.
Yeah, in there, everything's a checklist.
That's a very strong opinion.
Uh-huh.
And so having something where that's flexible enough, that has like enough features that it sort of doesn't have any opinions anymore, but mm-hmm. not so many features that you can just do literally anything, because there's a really, like, really difficult fine line to walk with anything, but definitely with productivity tools and software. I'm just trying to find that sweet spot.
This is interesting. I one of the books I read on the trip is this this old book called Composition. So it's supposed to be, this is one of the best art books that exists apparently, about sort of how to draw, how to think about drawing, that sort of thing. And the guy who wrote it has this very interesting concept of what he calls dither. And so the basic idea is that if you make a mechanical engine, like a car engine, and you have 100% fit between the pistons and whatever the pistons go into, I don't know what it's called, but that the piston sort of
case. The piston tube.
The piston tube.
Yep.
If you have 100% fit, in other words, it's like perfect, the engine doesn't work. Okay. So.
Because there needs to be airflow or something.
There needs to be
some
give actually to that space. There need to be able to sort of rattle a little bit in order for the engine to function. But of course, if you do it too much.
Then it flops around.
Then the engine is just like rickety as fuck and loses power. And so there's this certain amount. And in the book, he's talking about it as the difference between, like, when you see someone render something with 100% realism, like an academic drawing, right? There's no liveliness to it. It's just exactly what it is. Yeah. And we talk about this in animation all the time.
And it can be technically impressive, but at the same time, kind of disappointing.
Kind of like you're like, I don't give a shit. Like, it's a great eyeball, but
I can just look outside.
Yeah. Right. So yeah, it's kind of like, every time I see one of those like colored pencil drawings where they'll like put a wine bottle next to the drawing and they're like, which one is the real one? And you can't tell. You know? It's like, I'm always so technically impressed.
Exactly.
Like, holy fuck. But I don't want to put that on my wall.
Yeah. It's technically impressive, but who cares?
Cause you could just take a picture of a wine bottle. Exactly. And put that on your wall.
That'd be weird. Yeah. His whole point is that like you definitely need that sort of academic approach. You need to be able to say render something, but that is not equivalent. Like the good part about the art comes from that dither is the idea. And so it sounds like actually in productivity software, this is the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like, if you have no give at all, this thing like has a very particular way of doing stuff and you can't bend it, then you actually lose productivity, right? It doesn't quite work. And then if you have the other side where like in workflowy, it's essentially just chaos. Like there are no checklists. It's just bullets.
Well, and because everything is, you can't be notified of stuff in workflowy. You can't attach dates to things and so you have to kind of come up with your own structure. And because things are nested, they just kind of, sometimes they just get lost.
Yeah.
Like they just land somewhere and then they're just there now. Mm-hmm. And if nobody remembers to look there, it's just gone.
Yeah.
It's just gone forever. Yeah. So, it's in a 10 deep list nested into oblivion.
Yeah. So. I wonder if that, and we've talked about this with our games too before. We're like, you know, you make the prototype and then there's this long phase where we're just sort of almost just playing catch up with all the currently existing products. And even with Levelhead, we've talked about this with its relationship to Super Mario Maker and how up until maybe like a month or two ago, we were just sort of getting up to a point where we were at that same level of features and that sort of thing.
Right, then
and
we get now, to differentiate.
Yeah, yeah. Now we get to add this sort of weird stuff that adds some extra fun wobble to the whole system. So I do wonder, I came across that concept in that book and I was like, this is just a good, it's just a really good idea. This idea that all of the art, all of the sort of power from these things exists when you have enough features to have power, but enough looseness to let that sort of play, you know, play happen. So,
yeah, is that you need a generic system that can do whatever you need,
mm-hmm.
and then whatever that might be,
but not too much.
But yeah, not, it might. The thing is, that it won't be stellar at any super specific thing, you know.
Yeah,
but it'll be good enough at a whole bunch of specific.
Well,
things.
For me, I think the thing that really sells Trello is that it's the idea of constant, like realizing that your work is actually made up of lots of small pieces.
Yeah.
And that if you concentrate all the information about any piece into one centralized little location, which is like a card, including like all the conversations that have happened around that thing, file attachments about it, questions about it, checklists about the progress, you know, like all that stuff, a description of the problem. Mm-hmm. You can even schedule dates on it. So if you need like to have mm-hmm. a meeting about it or something, you know, you can do that. And then you can have responsible parties. You know, like if you take all those pieces together – and like all those are just attached to any one thing. So we even have, you know, we have our quarterly meeting coming up today. And so there's a Trello card for that. We're all assigned to it. And then there's a checklist of all the things that we need to talk about. And it works for a meeting planning tool, right. You know, as well as handling art assets and stuff like that. So
I'm excited about it.
I'm pretty pumped. I'm just high. I'm high on that Trello mm-hmm. life right now. Then otherwise, the last kind of bit of studio news to talk about four questions is that I streamed game development this past weekend.
Yeah.
Which the impetus was I've been doing a lot more poking around with sort of just like trying to get my hobbyist game dev legs back because I feel like only working on one project all the time, it kind of too narrowly focuses your view of what is good and like what tools you need. And it also prevents you from being exposed to potentially weird ideas because you just get too close to the problems you're dealing with. So by working on side projects,
need some new context.
Yeah, you just have new problems to solve, and especially early in development when you like a lot of the problems you solve are a lot of the problems of early dev, which requires a lot of tools development mm-hmm. because you tend to be like early in a game's life cycle, you tend to be solving a lot of the same problems as you would in just about any other game, right?
How do you save? How do you load? How do you handle this menu?
Yeah. And so every now and then you come across something and you're like, oh, I've been doing this thing manually a lot. Maybe I should come up with a system for that. And so I've been working on that stuff and I thought, you know, rather than just do it alone, it would be kind of cool if I just streamed it and then just kind of posted that into the community Discord. And so I did that on Saturday morning. I streamed from 8 a.m. to noon. I had seven to nine people in there just watching and asking questions and chatting about stuff. But it was fucking awesome. I felt like Bob Ross in the sense that, because I was like, I'm just making this game for fun.
Just going to put some happy little variables in here.
Yeah.
No variables are wrong.
Because I think there's an important thing that you have to understand about streaming is that, you know, there are people watching and you want to keep things moving. Mm-hmm. So that it's not just like super dumb and boring. And so I wasn't working on my game with a specific plan in mind, but I tried to make it a point to sort of bias toward doing things that would have pretty quick feedback and that I could sort of show the results of in pretty short order. And I made just a ton of progress on this little game project because I had to just keep doing stuff that like whatever popped into my mind that would be a cool thing to do, I would just do that thing. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about like that whole bias toward action concept. And interestingly, you know, streaming just kind of pushes you into that mindset.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you can't just sit there and be like, I'm going to think about this for half an hour. No, you got to just start doing stuff because people are watching.
Well, it's also interesting though, because I think it does make it so that it precludes some of the realities of the work though, right? Because a lot of game dev is like, you guys spend a lot of time just sort of leaning back or just leaving with a notepad.
There's a lot of kind of frowning and consternation.
Yeah. And so there's an interesting thing where there's always this this difference between what generally you see as the work, the reality of the work versus what it actually is. And so I do wonder, like, to what extent, you know, because it's really cool to like bang out a bunch of the interesting stuff fast.
Yeah.
But of course, at some point.
At some point, I'm going to need to just take 4 hours and develop some elaborate system without interruption.
Or just refactor everything, right?
Yeah.
And I think the question is, will you stream that? Because it's one of those things where like, it might not be necessarily.
I might.
Yeah, I think you should because it's one of those things.
Just to show the whole thing.
Yeah. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to
also show some self-doubt while you're doing it too.
Yeah. Kind of like that scene in The Flash when he's like, I don't know. I don't want to.
That's totally true.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to start trying to stream on Saturday mornings, ooh, Central Time.
That's it. What is that? Twitch.tv/bscotch.
Yeah. So this upcoming Saturday, I'll definitely be doing it from 8 a.m. to noon.
Cool.
And then next.
That's CST.
CDT. One of those, whichever one.
CS/DT.
Whichever one Missouri's in, that's where we are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So.
Specifically St. Louis, just in case there's some like weirdo city that doesn't follow the rules or something.
Yeah,
those do exist.
And then the inspiration for the game that I'm working on for streaming is basically Goop Legacy in space. I was like, it's called Space Bump.
And pretty good.
You just a little dumb spaceship that's kind of hard to control.
You bump into
there's tons of shit everywhere. There's asteroids. There's like weird like balls of gum. There's like just stuff in space.
There's a lot of gum in space.
And the idea will be, cause like there's tons of space games out there and they're all just unbelievably complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So like, what if I take sort of the complexity of a space game in terms of like, there's lots of different stuff going on, but boil it down to the simple interaction of you've got lots of stats
and then you bump
into stuff and then you decide what to do. Mm-hmm. So I want to have it where like, maybe you bump into a ship and then you've got a couple options, you know, maybe you want to hail them and try to talk to them. But then, you have communication skills as your stats.
And so then two radar dishes come up.
And they start slapping each other. maybe it's like a merchant and you want to trade with them. But of course,
two bags of money come up.
Mm-hmm. But you want to negotiate, right? And like try to get better prices. So like your pilot comes up and their pilot comes up and then they start negotiating, slapping each other.
You had this idea when we were walking around in China about a new... Because I think in one of the new Cyberpunk 77, they have a new dialogue system that they're showing where like you can, while you're interacting with an NPC, you can also look around the environment and then like talk about things that you see. But of course, it actually ends up being the same sort of thing where it'll end up playing more like one of those lookout games where like before you start or when you start the conversation, you're just going to like quickly, you know, look around and see if there's anything there. So
can you also imagine, you know, what that would look like in real life if you're trying to talk to somebody, they're just like looking. Just like, everywhere else.
Like a 360. Yeah.
Interrupting so that's you kind suddenly. Of like talking to somebody who has an Apple Watch.
Yes. Yeah.
Very annoying. But yeah, so I was thinking, what if you had a patience system? Because I realized in all my conversations that I had over there that there was a level of patience because I don't speak Chinese fluently by any stretch. So I could get like one or two things out and then otherwise it was just a lot of pantomiming. And so I feel like I could just like see a patience meter on people, right? Yep. where it's like you initiate the conversation and patience just starts going down.
Yeah. And you've got a race to get your point across
before it completely goes
before
out.
Before patience runs out.
And if you're smiling and if you're like very good natured, then the patience burns more slowly.
Yeah. That's your charisma stat.
Exactly. Yeah. But otherwise, like the things you do, you could sometimes just like knock patience way down, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It might be a fun dialogue system that we could put in.
Yeah. But I mean, I like the idea of just like boiling almost every interaction down to sort of a bunch of different stats and then vaguely random outcomes from those stats. Like if you want to trade with somebody, maybe you can't actually choose the things you want to trade with them. You just have a bunch of items in your inventory. They have a bunch of items. Mm-hmm. Then you've got a bunch of stats. And then you go and you encounter them. And whoever's better at trading sort of comes out on average with the better pile of goods at the end.
We've been having this conversation a bunch recently about level head and Rumpus and about this whole moderation problem that we have about how do we make it so that people can choose what happens and choose how to represent themselves without letting them be assholes to each other, right? So
it's a fine line.
The perennial problem.
Because some people are assholes.
Yes.
And when they represent themseles to the world, then
they make other people's lives worse. Right.
They'll choose a name for their avatar that's horrible.
Choose a name for their avatar, choose a name for their level.
Yeah.
And last week, I think it was Sher brought up the idea of, what if we just had like almost like an emoji set, but basically our own sort of set of things that convey some idea, but they're ideas that we control. And instead
like,
of people,
so people are using like hieroglyphics basically. To name so their level.
Because the fact is like a level name doesn't really convey much information anyway. Mm-hmm. We're having this conversation. I was thinking when I played Super Mario Maker and I would go to the level options and like almost everything I saw was in Japanese or in other languages, which I couldn't read anyway, so it might as well have been hieroglyphics, which of course would be true for presumably people from other countries who don't speak English looking at my levels, right?
So if everybody has to learn some new set
if there's some like third-party thing that just conveys ideas, then we solve a whole, like just a stupid number of problems at once but we take something away. So the same idea is like with this bumping game where you take away all these complex interaction mechanics that are super difficult and costly to implement and also hard to understand, but could be very cool and interesting. And the same deal here, like we take away a person's ability just to say exactly what they want, but we solve all these other problems at the same time. So then you have this question of like,
I think that's only true for a little while, because the reality is every game I've played where they like reduce everything down to emojis, the culture of the game eventually decides what the emojis mean.
Yeah, that's right. True.
So at some point I was playing Duelist.
But importantly, now that means different countries can talk to each other. Through the emoji.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But the thing is, like, I think that's the thing to understand is it's
not at some point an eggplant becomes a dick.
Exactly.
I mean,
an eggplant always becomes a dick. So you gotta just kind of.
Which, but here's the thing, though.
It's like, if you're not in on that culture, you wouldn't know that. Because, I didn't know that eggplant meant dick until like a year after that happened.
It is also just very amusing.
Yeah. Like that's exactly it. It's like, if somebody, you know, names their level head level with a sequence of characters that collectively mean something negative because people kind of decided that it does. I would still much prefer that to just the thing being written in plain English.
Yeah, because you also have to think about the fact that like we have if we want to get the game out to other cultures that speak other languages and we allow them to name their levels, then we need a team of moderators / translators to convert the level names into things that we can read. But if we just can we not?
What if we just didn't have anything?
Can we not?
Yeah. Anyway, we've had a lot of fun just like, especially the past couple of weeks, just kind of trying to like really drill down and just ask, what can we just really get away with?
Can we just not?
You know?
Yeah.
Because
we're
going to
maybe
like,
not. Well, I don't know. We'll talk about it today during our giant meeting. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyways, I think it's just important because you always feel like you have to do things a certain way because like it feels like you would lose so much by, in a space game, taking away flying the spaceship or having interactive combat or whatever, but you know,
do you though?
You know,
well, I mean, it just becomes a different thing.
Exactly.
Well, and you also have to understand, like, you know, there's that God of the gaps, you know, which is the idea that people's minds fill in stories wherever you put gaps. Mm-hmm. So like if for the trading aspect of the game is you go up there, they go up there, and then literally all of your cargo shows up in a pile behind your pilot, and like their cargo shows up in a pile. And then they start slapping each other, and then different pieces of cargo just start flying back
it's
and forth.
It's going to be awesome. People will get what's happening.
Then people are like, they're trading.
Yeah.
Like they're having a very deep discussion about the prices of these items.
Because all you have to do is change the sound effect. So like now when they're slapping each other, you just make kind of the sound of like mumbled conversation.
And then like occasional cash register ka-chings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then you just like every now and then somebody will get like a critical negotiation. And because the thing is like every item has a value assigned to it, right? And so if I've got an item that's worth like 1,000 space dollars and you've got like 50 items that are each worth 20, you know, then presumably my guy should be able to like throw the 1,000 item at you and then your guy throws the 50 items mm-hmm. back, right? But if I get a crit, because like I throw my 1,000 at you and then your guy throws like an extra $200 worth of stuff at me, mm-hmm. you know, then I'm coming out on top. That's right.
So, yeah, but it's cool though, because now you've taken what would otherwise be a whole bunch of completely disparate mechanics that all have to be separately conceived of and coded
you need
up
an
and
interface
tested
for like,
and balanced, yeah. need new interfaces. Now you just have one interface, one balance, mm-hmm. one mechanic, but you get to dress it up so that it just feels like different things are happening.
Yeah. Right? So like if I want to mine an asteroid, you know, I bang into an asteroid, like maybe my ship normally can do that, right? It's like, that's just a thing all ships can do, but not very well. So then like the asteroid shows up, my ship shows up, they slap against each other, right. rocks
pieces
come
of rock
out,
fall off.
People, pieces of rocks come out. Those
or
go
chip
in.
Off and reveal something.
Yeah.
Like a geode.
But then like if I attach a module to my ship, you know, then all of a sudden now the next time I bang into an asteroid, now my ship is slapping it and there's like lasers shooting everywhere too. And like then sometimes I get like a diamond out of it, you know. So I mean you just take this, I don't know. Like I was looking at Goop Legacy and I was like, this is just good. Like just the idea of just slapping things together and then using stats to tell the story, it works great.
Well, essentially what you're doing is you have like really robust systems on the left. And you have one single throughput mechanism, which is slapping.
Yeah.
And then every other external output on the other side, right?
Yeah.
So it's just a beautiful sort of one of those diagrams. What's it called? A Python, where it's super fat on one end, skinny, and then super fat again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's nice. And then you can add all kinds of weird stuff to the game because it's so easy to add stuff, mm-hmm. you know? So I'll be streaming that this Saturday morning, 8 a.m. to noon.
Cool.
Central time. All right, let's get on to some questions.
At twitch.tv/bscotch.
At twitch.tv/bscotch. All right, these questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. So if you'd like to get your questions on to future episode, get over there, put your questions in the text box. First question comes from Upscatnings Man. Hola. It was really interesting to hear how you all worked together at the beginning of this year's Shenanigam to brainstorm a starting point for the game that eventually became Goop Legacy. But I think a lot of us would like to hear how the rest of your process was like, because the game seemingly turned out nothing like the game you talked about in the kickoff podcast. Hugs and kisses. That is true.
Well, the kickoff podcast was a different thing.
Yeah. That was just a demo of kind of how the process goes.
You took a video, didn't you, of the brainstorming session?
There is a video.
I did, yes.
We should put that somewhere.
We did. We do have a video. So, but like it was a totally separate thing. I definitely understand how that would have been confusing. Yeah. So we'll need to make that more clear going forward. Our next question comes from CDC Molly. So thank you for your service in preventing diseases. We're all in your debt. CDC Molly says, hey, B-Bros, I absolutely love everything you guys have done/are doing. Dev Diaries, Game Dev Podcast, Game Jams. Totally awesome. Question. I've been toying with game dev for years now, but I'm finally getting in there and really learning and doing. I'm looking for some experience advice regarding the business aspect of creating a studio. I've never started a business before and I have no idea where to begin or if it's even necessary, especially if my games actually lead to bigger things for my career. Thanks.
Yeah, I think the first question is just what are you doing
just why?
With them? Because if you want to make, if you want to pull in any cash from them, then you need some form of a legal entity.
Yes, you can't. You can publish games under your own name, but I think anytime you're engaging in commercial activity, you should do so under a legal company.
Yeah, we're not lawyers. This is not legal advice. But our legal advice would be if we were lawyers, knew what we were talking about, which may or may not actually be true.
Well, there is
to get a legal entity between you and any other.
Yeah, and I mean that's just a fact of the law.
Yeah.
Which is that having a business that you are operating under, it does in all likelihood, because like there's no guarantees in law, mm-hmm. right? There's a thing called piercing the corporate veil in law, which is when people sort of make the case that you were not acting on behalf of the company and then instead you were acting personally, and that if you broke the law, then they pierce through the corporate
and they stab you
screen, mm-hmm. they poke you, and then you go to jail. But yeah, so I mean, you got to think, you don't really know what kinds of nonsense you might get into. For example, you start making a game and some large company says, hey, this is a lot like my game. Boom, sued for trademark infringement. Mm-hmm. Do you want to
be sued, or do you want to be sued?
Or do you want your company, who has no money, to be sued, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you personally get sued, now you and everything you own, all of your assets are on the line and can be taken from you.
So what we did to start the studio, we just had an LLC, which I think Seth set up on LegalZoom.
Yeah, it's like $150 $150 or something.
So we all put in $500.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we seeded the company.
Yeah, you'll need a bank account, and then a credit card.
Once you have an LLC, then you can get a bank account or credit card for your company. You can put some of your own money into it, and then you need to be very careful. And again, you know, try to talk to some like actual legal people, mm-hmm. but then you just try to, as very carefully as possible, things that are for the business, you buy with the business's.
Yeah, bank account, you keep a firm separation between self and company, so you don't use your business card to like buy yourself a new bicycle mm-hmm. or something unless you're a BMX biker company. Mm-hmm. Well,
if you're using it to ride to work, it can now be a company expense, but the company does own that now. So if your company does get sued,
your bike's gone.
Your bike is one of the assets.
Yeah.
That's up.
So that's sort of like the easiest way to do it. And I think that probably only takes. Once you talk to someone about it, that's like maybe an hour conversation. Go to your bank and talk to someone, and then maybe have a 10-minute conversation with someone on LegalZoom even.
Because LegalZoom, you can have actual lawyers get involved with it too. So.
Yep. And then the final piece of that is that once you have a separate company, then you need to file your taxes separately.
Yes.
So your company will have to have its own accountant, like its own tax filings.
Which you can do that yourself. Or we can have an accountant who can then just handle all that shit.
Yeah. And so in our case, I think we didn't actually make any money the first year that Butterscotch was founded because we didn't get anything really published.
Mm-hmm.
We formed the studio in June of 2012.
Yeah, we didn't start full-time work until November, I think.
We started full-time work in November, and our first legit launch was Towel Fight, which just lost a bunch of money.
Yeah, and that was in February of the next fall.
But it was still the case that, you know, we found an accountant who, like, we explained our situation and we're like, yeah, you know, we don't really have much money. We do have a few hundred in the bank, basically. And I think early on it was just a couple $100 to get our taxes done, mm-hmm. which for us was a peace of mind thing. We're just like,
I think of this purely at this level. So when you don't know if you're going to make any money, but you do, if you do intend to commercially release your games, then to me, a business is not. At the beginning, it's not a mechanism to make money. It's actually an insurance scheme.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's a mechanism to protect you from various kinds of legal and like tax liabilities.
And then once you do have money, then it's a way to protect that money and to make sure that you are sort of on the up and up under the law.
Yep.
So, yeah, anytime somebody is publishing games under their own personal name, it just makes me very nervous mm-hmm. just for them. Yeah. You know?
Unless it says, comma, LLC afterward, in which case,
because you can name an LLC after yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, you can do that. It's definitely a good thing to do. Things like LegalZoom are fine.
Of course, assuming you're in the U.S., because I don't know jack all about how anything works anywhere else.
It's much easier to make businesses in the U.S., apparently.
Yeah.
From what I've heard.
Yeah.
Which is weird because it still is kind of pain in the ass.
It's a pain in the ass, but if you go somewhere else, it's way.
It's all to say that there are costs involved. There's time involved. It's all complicated. It's always best to rope in experts to figure this stuff out. And so
there's not that many steps though. I think is the
It's not as hard as you think. It's not as costly as you think, or it doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. It definitely can be if you rope in certain kinds of people into the process. But it's one of the things. If you can afford to do it, then just like insurance. You should have it because there's a lot of protection that you get.
Yeah. But if on the other hand, like you mentioned in the question, if this is just for sort of career advancement where you just want to be able to show a portfolio, for example, then who gives a shit? I mean, you put your stuff
put it up on itch.
Yeah, put up on itch. Put it up for free. Like if your whole goal is to be able to say like, hey, I made this game and it has like 10,000 downloads on itch or something like that, you know, that's a whole different thing. That can totally be just a hobbyist thing. You don't have to worry about money and all that stuff. But if you do want to pull any cash in, I just highly recommend getting an LLC.
Yes.
It would take probably a day or two of sort of, you know, toiling and figuring all that crap out.
Yeah, but it's worth it. It's a good peace of mind.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, next question comes from Anonymous. You always mention the dads. Can you elaborate?
I thought this question was funny because I was like, this is actually very straightforward.
You know? Yeah.
So our dad's gay.
Yeah. And
then he got married.
So now we got two of them.
Now we got two of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
We have a lot of parents. Nowadays, as it turns
out.
Yeah,
it's a good position to be in.
Yeah, I feel like the more parents you get, it's like more people you got just to keep you on an even keel. Yeah,
that's right.
More coaches you got.
More the better.
That's right.
Yeah, so our parents got divorced when we were 8. I was 8.
We were 11. Different ages. Yeah. As 11, is always the case.
You were 12, right? Around there.
Must have been something around like that.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's an interesting story in and of itself. But I think one of my favorite tidbits from it was, of course, this is like 96. And so keep in mind that, you know, like it still was very bad, considered very bad, basically everywhere in the States to be gay, right? So aside from like some of the big metropolitan centers like New York, whatever else.
Well, even then.
Well, even there.
It was a rough time.
Yeah. And
things were improving, but yeah.
Yeah. So there wasn't even like the sort of general, it's a weird one, but there is sort of a cultural thing about like having good fashion sense or good taste or good like hygiene and stuff weren't necessarily attributed in a broader sense to like gay culture. And so it was just like kind of a bad thing. And we're in Iowa. We're in the middle of, you know, Grinnell. So very, again, we're in a village. And luckily there's a college in the town. So it's a slightly more liberal leaning village. But our dad, parents got divorced and then our dad sat us down, I think about 6 months afterward, because we didn't quite know what was going on because they always got along great. And he just, you know, I think we were having spaghetti at his new apartment.
Yeah.
And we're all just sitting there, and he was apparently very nervous because he was going to tell us. He's going to come out to us. We had no idea. And so he's like, boys, so the reason we got divorced was because I'm gay. And remember, all of us were just sitting there kind of eating our spaghetti. And I think Adam was the one who said something along the lines of, is that all?
Is that it? Like, you've told us for 6 months?
What the fuck, man?
I thought it was something bad. Yeah.
Because again, we're too young at that point to even know. We haven't been enculturated, right, at that point to this idea that it's bad. And so, I mean, I think I've definitely followed suit with whatever Adam's response was because I'm 8. I don't know anything.
I got no opinions.
So Adam's just sort of amused by this. I'm amused. And apparently this is a huge relief, as you might imagine, for our dad to find out that we don't have any opinions about anything. So I think the next question was, are you still going to be around? And he was like, well, yeah. And then we're like, who cares?
Yeah, it's
we don't
fine.
Give a shit. So,
and then as a bonus, we get extra dad.
Yeah, we got a second dad, which is great. So, and he's wonderful, absolutely wonderful. So, yeah, it's been a bit of a weird journey back in the day, but it's been great.
It's been awesome. Yeah. So there you go. That's
some of the story.
That's some of the story.
Yeah, there's plenty in there.
All right. Next question comes from I Like Eating Pie, which
don't we all?
Yeah.
Which you're not wrong.
In Flop Rocket, as far as I can tell, the rocket seems to be approximately 1 meter wide. The pilot, who frequently explodes their way out of that vessel, is about 1 meter tall. All the other people around the launch pad are much smaller, maybe a third of a meter tall. So we've got a 3-foot rocket piloted by a 3-foot person.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
surrounded by 1-foot people.
But you're assuming that all the things around the rocket are people.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Okay.
Does the M actually stand for a meter like I originally thought? That would make everyone really tiny. Is there official lore for this? Also, that potato is huge. Is there any official lore for that?
That potato can also fly.
The potato flies and is wearing
and has fists.
It has fists and a bandana.
Well, you're talking about where the potato came from.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right. So if you turn your thrust all the way to, because actually most people don't even know this. Yeah. If you turn your thrust all the way to zero in Flop Rocket, you become a sentient potato.
A sentient potato with hands that has terrible terrible rocket skills.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you get a special hidden achievement if you make it to space as a potato. So,
which is very hard to do.
And people have done it.
Yeah.
So where that came from is we made a game for, was that one of the Pixel Pop festivals?
We made it
the first one?
For the first Pixel Pop, and it was a talk about just how a game comes together. Mm-hmm. So we jammed out this game called Hot Spuds.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically a Smash Bros. Style game where you knock each other off of an arena and you play as potatoes and you throw bombs at each other.
Uh-huh. And then you're trying to get butter.
Yeah, every now and then butter appears and you got to like butter yourself.
Yeah, so you go over and your little hands would rub the butter and
that's how you earn points.
Yeah.
And if you get exploded while you're rubbing the butter, then you
just go flying.
You go flying and you lose your butter rubs.
Yeah.
You need to knock people away from the butter long enough that you can go rub the butter.
Yeah.
And then once the butter gets fully rubbed, it disappears and then a moment passes, and then a new butter appears somewhere else on the level.
Mm-hmm.
It was fucking awesome, actually.
it took us a day to make. And also, it worked like a PowerPoint. So Seth would, I think you just hit the right arrow, and it would add the next layer of stuff that we added to the game.
I sort of added a bunch of markers in the code where we could sort of peel back the layers of what was happening. So if you wanted to just look at the game as black and white with like just a level and no characters, then you could do that. And then if you want to just see like bounding boxes, but see the characters with the bounding boxes, then we did like sprites on top, but no animations.
So it goes from being a black void to being this fully polished.
Yeah. So I think we broke it into 16 steps or something. Yeah. And so you get to see all the under the hood. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's
there a video of that.
Hey, there might be. You probably looked.
Yeah. I don't think I ever actually got to see it in action.
It's hilarious. And we actually had people came up and played it for like 30 minutes after, like on, cause we had controller support, I think, for it.
Yeah. And we had up to four players and people came in and
just fought each other.
They just played hot spuds.
It's just hilarious.
Cause we opened up for questions and then we just also allowed people to play the game.
Yeah. So the potato came from that and we just had it. And then I think we were making Flop Rocket. And
this was like, I think it was just after we launched Flop Rocket, wasn't it? We just, I came back for a, a repass just like to add.
I don't know. It was a while later and I didn't even know what the hell happened. But
I think what happened was I had coded up the thrust and I accidentally coded it in such a way that you could actually reduce it
to zero,
below this baseline. Mm-hmm. And instead of fixing that bug, we just had the conversation like, what if just something really stupid happened when you took your thrust all the
way
down?
And we were like, well, we have this potato.
Yeah.
We've got it.
We've got something stupid.
We've got something dumb. Oh man, we should have put butter in there instead of fuel pads.
Yeah. But you had to sit next to it and rub it for a while.
Yeah.
if we make a remastered version, then we can.
Yes.
So as far as the lore goes, I think there's also a question of depth, right? Because your camera's looking at this thing.
Yeah, the potato might be really close to the camera.
Exactly. The people might be super far away.
Yeah.
And the rocket might actually, might be some weird.
This is one of those problems with 2Ds. You just can't really tell.
Who knows?
What's going on, you know?
Yeah. I think the idea is that.
It also could be that when the rocket explodes and the, pilot comes flying out, that the pilot first flies towards the camera really fast. Mm-hmm. But so fast, you don't see them grow. They're just like suddenly they're really big. You know?
Yeah.
And then because there's like another 2D sort of plane up there in the way, they kind of get stuck on it. Mm-hmm. And then they appear to be that size.
It's like a bird hitting a piece of glass.
Exactly. Yeah. And then as far as the super tiny people around the launch pad, which are maybe a third of a meter, those are actually like the little robots that you see in the spaceship in Crashlands. Mm-hmm. The problem is we just don't have enough pixels, to render them.
I believe they're called Millers.
They're code, millers
because they mill about.
They mill.
Yeah.
They mill about the launch pad. And then when you fire the engine, they leave because they're like, fuck this. I'm getting out of here.
This is actually one of those really interesting notes about adding just a few of these details to make a thing feel very much more alive, right? Because we didn't have to put those in there. They literally do not. They don't do anything.
They just mill.
But it took, I think, maybe 4 minutes to make. It's a circle with like a cone on the bottom of it as far as how the body works.
Yeah. Then just anytime we spawn a launch pad or a fuel pad or whatever, we just also spawn some millers. Mm-hmm. And then whenever they're off screen, they just destroy themselves.
Uh-huh. And when the rocket comes by, they run away. That's it. And so it adds this sort of feeling of like, oh, this is like a little weird space, like a NASA.
There must be somebody building these.
Yeah.
It is true that then the giant potato and like the giant astronaut kind of throw that out of whack a bit, but just
realism has never been one of our strengths.
Remember that it's not a realistic scale model. It's an explanation of what's happening.
This goes back to the dithering idea, right? If it was 100% realistic, it wouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, if you had a legit pilot come out of that thing, it'd be one pixel.
Yeah, and if we had to fly a potato, it would also be like a sub-pixel thing.
Yeah.
So all you would see is basically kind of the jet trail of this thing flying around. Maybe it's giant fists because it can still have giant fists.
Now, of course, when we launch Flop Rocket sort of Kerbal Space Program style, that edition of the game, then things will be to scale. But in the meantime.
No, actually, I think they won't be. We'll just have two different kinds of people. We'll have the giants whose entire bodies are just encased in rockets.
Yeah, it's very hard to launch them into space.
Yes. And then we'll have people making this stuff, which are like the Kerbals, just like kind of walking around. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Maybe they pilot like a Jaeger that then gets into the rocket.
Yeah. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah. So it's just a huge mech inside of a rocket.
Yeah. So this is because they weren't good enough at making mechs yet. All they could do is just put fire on stuff. Mm-hmm.
You know? I know we've had people ask this question too about Flux, because Flux is very pointy feet.
Yes.
And they're like, she's
also handless.
Mm-hmm. Well, she does have hands, but they're just sort of drawn on there.
Yeah. She has clenched fists.
Yeah. A billboard sort of situation. People are like, does she not have feet? I'm like, well, no. It's just it was much easier to make boots this way.
Yeah, what we discovered is with that animation style, if you put feet on there, then it looks stupid as hell.
Yeah. It looks real weird.
Yeah. Like, so like when you're whipping your when you're whipping your legs forward and back like that, if you've got these like static feet on the bottom, then it just totally kills the illusion. Yeah. So we had to kind of turn our feet into pogo sticks, basically.
Yeah, and we had this huge conversation because we were like, okay, we want to put armor on in this game that you can just start strapping on all this cool stuff. But if we do that, that means like the necessary complexity of the animations has to go down to almost zero. In fact, did go down to zero because if you have, say, two frames, even of just the arm as it's swinging, and you have a glove now you need to put on there, now you have to draw that glove
two perspectives,
two different times.
At that point, you might as well go 3D.
I mean,
you
know what I mean? Just get out of here. So that's part of the reason why the game has so much content, is because Flux has pointy legs.
Yeah.
But so, in reality, does she have pointy legs? No.
Maybe she does.
Well, I mean, if you look at the Crash and Its comic,
she has regular feet.
You'll see she's got awesome ass boots on, which I kind of want those boots. They're super cool.
Pretty red.
Do you mention the fat headed slurper that arrived in the mail?
I think we did.
We
talked about it on Discord. Yeah, Quantum Anomaly made a little clay fat headed slurper,
which is one of the fish that you fish out in Crashlands,
and mailed it to us, and it's fucking awesome.
It also happens to be exactly the right scale for another piece of fan work, fan sculpture we got
that Kevin sent.
Kevin 888.
Yeah. I think he's now Kevin 11.
Kevin 11. He keeps getting either larger or smaller. I don't know what the number.
But so the fat headed slurper is almost like perfectly sized as they are in relation in game to Flux, which is hilarious. So now they're just sitting up on our mantle next to our Dice Awards.
And so if anybody out there wants to make more, you know, small Crashlands objects out of clay, just send them our way and we will add them to the ensemble.
We should probably put up a blog post or something that showcases the
goofy stuff we've got.
Yes. Yeah. We did at some point have a fan art thing, portal, something or other.
We still do because the link still exists and that it just takes you to a Google form.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we gotta Adam to do that. All right.
Nah.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producer, Fat Bart, for making us sound good. And of course, for overhauling our new podcast room to be super cool. Actually, it's pretty hot in here.
Yeah, it's getting warm.
With something we're going to need to fix. That's not a Fat Bard problem.
There's an AC behind Adam.
Yeah, yes. We're almost done, so I'll just let it slide, I think.
Also, thank you to our community moderators who keep our Discord and forums running. If you'd like to get more involved in the Butterscotch community, you can hop into our Discord server at discord.gg/bscotch and come say hello. If you'd like to adorn your body with Butterscotch merch, you can check out our shop over at shop.bscotch.net. Or if you'd like to send us something, we have a mailbox, which you can find the address for over at mailbox.bscotch.net. Finally, if you'd like to donate or otherwise buy us a cup of coffee or just kind of show your support for the podcast in a financial way, you can throw us money over at tips.bscotch.net. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.